That is the sound you never want to hear. It's the sound of the warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. When you hear that sound, it means you are in the nuclear hot seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Hallady. I'm the producer and host of this podcast, and I was 1 mile from Three Mile Island when it happened, so I'm very motivated to keep doing this work. Today is Tuesday, May 15th, 2012, 1 year and 65 days since the Fukushima Daiichi tragedy began on March 11th of 2011, and here is the latest nuclear news. We're starting out in India today, where the protest against the Kudankulam nuclear power plant continues. At least 330 people who have been on hunger strike in protest against a nuclear power plant project in the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu face imminent arrest after police have issued orders prohibiting the protest and surrounding their village. In March, more than 180 people were arrested for protesting against the Kudankulam nuclear power plant. All but two were released within a month, but some of the protesters already face charges of sedition, meaning crimes against the state, waging war against the state, conspiracy, and rioting with deadly weapons for their involvement in the protests, all of which, by the way, were completely peaceful on the part of the protesters. If convicted of these charges, they could face sentences as high as life imprisonment. Amnesty International believes the charges are false and constitute a deliberate attempt by the authorities to silence the protests. Meanwhile, the former Chief Justice of the Delhi High Court, Ajit Prakash Shah, today said he would take steps to take the Kudankulam protesters issue to the National Human Rights Commission. He told reporters that state government cannot file sedition charges against people for protesting against nuclear energy. 337 protesters have been sitting in an indefinite fast for 10 days. This was the report as of the 12th of May. Most of the women's conditions have become serious, and there were inadequate medical facilities to treat them. No steps on their behalf have been taken by the government of India. After intense discussion and the insistence of common people, most of the indefinite hunger strikers were asked to withdraw their fast. As of now, the most current information is that 97 people, 94 women and 3 men, have remained in indefinite fast in Idinthakurai, and police are trying to enter into the village to arrest the leaders of the protest. A little bit of good news. We have found out that the nuclear energy policy in Britain is on the verge of meltdown, as experts predict that the new French government will order the EDF to divert billions of euros intended for new UK reactors back into the French domestic power market. After The Times, the London newspaper, revealed on May 8th the soaring cost of building Britain's 4 planned new reactors, industry analysts said that they believed the forthcoming administration of the anti-nuclear socialist François Hollande could force EDF to scrap its UK nuclear plans. With Mr. Hollande planning to slash French reliance on nuclear power by 25% by 2025, it is argued that EDF could be forced to switch billions of euros to fund investment in French renewables and energy-efficient schemes, to which I can only say woohoo. More good news coming out of Iowa. In a major blow to the nuclear industry, on May 10, the Iowa legislature adjourned without passing a bill that would have paved the way for MidAmerica Energy to charge ratepayers in advance for new nuclear reactor construction. The utility would have been allowed to keep the money even if construction was never completed. Now, this is better than a Ponzi scheme. MidAmerica lobbied extensively for the bill, but Iowa ratepayer concerns about nuclear power doomed the proposal. The Iowans were smarter than the pro-nukers. A poll sponsored by the Des Moines Register in January found that over three-quarters of Iowans were opposed to the measure. Moving on to Japan, where the news is not good. The appointment of the chairman of Japan's publicly funded broadcaster, NHK, which is the equivalent of PBS here, to the board of Tokyo Electric Power Company, that's right, the head of the network is now on the board of Tokyo Electric Power Company, has raised concerns about its unbiased reporting on the utility and possible conflict of interest. A senior NHK official said that the chairman's appointment might raise concerns among viewers about its reporting. Why will a top executive of a media organization now join TEPCO, the most important subject of media coverage, among all possible organizations, the official asked. Well, there's certainly a pro-nuke position on that, but the anti-nuke one is resign immediately. In Tokyo, as reported by the Nikkan SPA, the article which just came out today said that this past February, super radioactive and mysterious black dust was found in Minamisoma City in Fukushima Prefecture. It was considered to be specific only to Minamisoma. However, the black dust is now found everywhere in Tokyo. It looks something like dried moss or mold, and samples have been collected and tested at Kobe University to measure the level of radiation. The result was that it had 243,000 becquerels per kilogram. That's radioactive black dust that is all over Tokyo. Here's good news, if you're naive enough to believe it. Sludge samples taken at the mouths of two major rivers emptying into Tokyo Bay, which is, of course, where they are dumping the ashes from the burning of the radioactive rubble from Fukushima. At the mouths of these two rivers emptying into Tokyo Bay, the sludge showed radioactive cesium contamination grew by 1.5 to 13 times its previous level since August of last year. This according to a researcher at Kinki University. In addition, and here's the naive part, the report said, quote, the contamination poses no immediate health risk, end quote. Now, of course, there's no immediate health risk because radiation, unless it's of immensely high amounts, is not going to make a healthy person keel over in the middle of the street. It will, however, accumulate in the body over time and do horrible things depending on the isotope and what parts of the body it attaches itself to. So while it's not a lie that it's no immediate health risk, does not mean that there's no health risk and that there's no direct connection between cause and effect. As a sidelight from our friend Mokizuki, who does Fukushima Diary online, there are now ads for infant radiation protective clothing in local newspapers. Leave it to capitalism to find a way to make money out of even the worst of situations. In Kawauchimura, which is in Fukushima, 3,100 becquerels of radioactive cesium was detected in wild mice caught in the mountains about 30 kilometers from Fukushima. That's about 17, 18 miles. The Forestry and Forest Products Research Institute also did the measurement of radioactive cesium in earthworms in the same area, and they found just under 20,000 becquerels per kilogram of radioactive cesium in earthworms. Can you imagine how many earthworms it took to get a whole kilogram of them? This location in Mitsuishi District is, as with the rest of Kawauchimura, in the areas newly designated as getting ready for the return of residents. In other words, they're moving people back in to this area where so much radiation is showing up in living beings. To help promote the moving back in, there was a promotional event this past weekend inside the former evacuation-ready zone. There were volunteers, including small children, planting rice. The Chamber of Commerce and Industry of the village of Minichi Shimbun planned the event, and about 50 volunteers, including families from the Tokyo metropolitan region, enjoyed rice planting the old-fashioned way, by hand, in the mud, in bare feet. One farmer who planted the rice last year said, even if this is only an experiment, it is the first step to agricultural renewal. Even if it cannot be sold right away, I want to continue to slowly persuade the consumers. I think this is the perfect introduction to our interview today because soil remediation from radiation and keeping it out of the food chain is a major subject that's going to be progressively on people's minds as the issues surrounding Fukushima continue to grow in magnitude. So I am delighted to have two guests on this week's Nuclear Podcast who can address various ways we can protect the food chain and also our personal health. Elisa Longyi has been an anti-nuclear activist since 1972, when as a 16-year-old she attended a two-day nuclear energy conference in Washington, D.C., and had the dangers of nuclear power explained by, among others, Margaret Mead, Ralph Nader, and Robert Redford. For her, it all broke down to, there is no safe long-term storage for the thousands of years needed until it all neutralizes. Elise now works locally in Ashland, Oregon, gathering community support and organizing landowners with mushroom growers to form radiation remediation cooperatives. She's also all over the internet sharing great information. Elisa, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. Very excited.
What is bioremediation and what is phytoremediation?
Phytoremediation is a general term for using plants, which are the phyto part, to remediate or clean up polluted sites. And bioremediation is basically just cleaning up the whole planet in different ways, using phytoremediation and mycoremediation, which are mushrooms.
So let's talk about mushrooms, because I know that they are one of the fastest absorbers of radiation. In fact, they were one of the first foods discovered in Fukushima to be radioactive, even though these particular samples were grown inside a greenhouse. Do you have any idea why mushrooms absorb radiation so readily?
Well, they take up a lot of water, and they live off of plants. They are parasitic in one respect, that they live off decomposing plants and topsoil and leaf litter. They can actually neutralize heavy metals and radiation to some degree, so that cleaning up the mushrooms after they've absorbed all of this, they can be composted and they will decompose and then put someplace a little safer than in your garden.
So in other words, the goal is to have the mushrooms absorb the radiation and fix it, but then we need to be very careful about how they are disposed of so that the radiation doesn't get either ingested or put back into the environment.
Yes, and so mushrooms do actually need to be grown with water that has been cleaned up, too. There are ways of cleaning up radioactive water that we could talk about also.
And what would be ways of cleaning up the radio? As long as we're here, let's talk about it. How do you clean it up?
It's debatable right now. I've been studying up on reverse osmosis. It is what the EPA suggests people use for cleaning heavy metals and radiation out of the water. The problem with some of the radioactive elements is that they become gas in water, and it's very hard to remove gases with reverse osmosis. But using activated carbon and ion exchange with the reverse osmosis will get 99% of radioactive contaminants out of water. So then that water can be used to grow the mycelium, and the mycelium will then clean the radiation out of the ground. I'd like to mention also that industrial hemp, was used during Chernobyl, and it was said that hemp eats Chernobyl waste. Oregon is the only state that has the intent for growing industrial hemp and has made it legal on a state level. So we have the opportunity here in Oregon to actually grow acres and acres of hemp if we can get licensed.
So, in other words, the damage to the planet can be reversed, at least to a certain extent, by the plants of the planet fighting against it.
Yes, absolutely. And after doing a cover crop of hemp, then planting our food crops and using water that has been decontaminated, and possibly putting a greenhouse over those plants so that more cesium doesn't fall on the ground while we're growing those plants is what I see happening in the very near future, if not right now.
Now, do you know of any farmers who are actually working to create this kind of a clean food environment for the crops that they are raising?
I do not know any at the moment. I am having a meeting on May 20th with some other people to bring the landowners and mycelium growers together to find places to start this process. And there are many people who are very interested in doing it, and I am hoping that spreading this word through the farmers' markets that have just opened again this year, we can team up with the farmers and mycelium growers to start doing this. We need to find farmers who don't use irrigation from rivers and creeks, but use well water. The radiation will get filtered through the ground, and well water is still clean here, whereas the rivers and creeks are questionable. They would have to be tested before we use that on plants.
You know, the contamination in Japan is so severe, and, of course, it's rising continuously because of either the burning of waste or continued emissions from Fukushima. How realistic is it that these kind of soil remediation programs would have any effect over there with that level of contamination?
There is a professor of nuclear science in Australia, and his name is Hui Yang Zhu. In 2010, he created a nanofiber, nanotube technology that will filter radiation out of water. And 1 gram of titanate nanofiber will filter a ton of water. So the nuclear industry funded his research so that they could find a way of having less to store. Instead of a ton of water to store, they'll have 1 gram of titanate nanoparticle, and the radiation will stay within that nanoparticle even if it gets wet in storage. He's hoping, this wonderful man said, we have the technology to do the cleaning up for the world. And that is a quote from Professor Zhu. So I think if this nanoparticle could be used in Japan along with growing industrial hemp, mycelium, and other mushrooms like reishi mushrooms, that eventually probably the outskirts of the most polluted areas could see someday people coming back and growing food safely. I think Fukushima area is pretty destroyed at this point, and the plutonium is a completely different creature. It's got a very, very long half-life of...
The half-life is 24,000 years, and it plays out to, depending on your math on it, either a quarter of a million or half a million years. So virtually forever.
Virtually forever, whereas cesium and strontium and iodide are a little bit shorter. I think that it's possible to do this in areas that are not as heavily damaged. But I would love to see this nanoparticle be used in Japan to filter people's water. That would be the first thing that I could see. And I am actually trying to get in touch with Pennsylvania State University, Penn State, to see what is happening with this technology.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that disturbs me about it, I mean, this is the first I've heard of it, and it's like, great, why can't we put some of that nuclear money behind it, whip up a huge batch of it, and, you know, and bring it over to Japan and start working on it, put it in the oceans, do it wherever we can. But my concern is that I've heard of other instances where the nuclear industry paid for research, and if they didn't like the results, they simply buried the research.
Yes.
So my concern is, if they are the ones who are paying for the funding, do they have the rights, do they have the patents on this? And if so, are they planning to utilize these materials?
Yes. Well, this is a big issue. There was, if I can talk about the Roy process a minute too, there was a physicist named Radha Roy who at 16 years of age received a doctorate from the University of Calcutta in nuclear science, and he, in 1979, neutralized radiation. He neutralized it by knocking off electrons and rendering it neutral. So he took cesium-137, and through the process that he actually patented, he changed it to cesium-136, and he took strontium-90 and altered it to strontium-89. They are no longer radioactive.
And why haven't we heard more about this individual's Roy's effect on radiation?
I've had a very hard time finding anything online about him. I did find a biography written by Dennis Nestor, who I contacted via Facebook, and it was a very interesting biography. The man was incredible. He was just incredible. And he also worked, interestingly enough, for the Penn State University. So Penn State University has programs that are related to the nuclear industry, and he retired early from Penn State University because he was the only physicist coming out against nuclear power in 1980. Let's see, I'm not exactly sure what that date was.
And that's odd because Pennsylvania was, of course, the site of Three Mile Island, which took place in 79.
Right, exactly. And he started getting death threats and harassed a lot, and was never able to use this technology, mostly because of a law that was passed during the Reagan administration. It prevented anybody from possessing any amounts of high-level radioactive waste or spent fuel, so no one could conduct any further research. And it was called the NWPA, Nuclear Waste Policy Act. It specifically stated that it had to be buried deep geological disposition of high-level radioactive waste and spent nuclear fuel, and that was the only way it could be disposed. So unfortunately for Dr. Roy and the world, what he had discovered and created was against the law. It became illegal.
That's just criminal, but not on his part, on the part of the lawmakers.
And what's amazing is that it is that radiation can be neutralized. Now, that's the biggest point. It's incredible.
That deserves to be headlines in the international media, and it deserves to also have a ton of money thrown at it immediately. So the fact that it's not just gives us another area to focus on, and I will follow up with you and see if there's further information to share or if there's just an activist action we can take to start moving forward on this, because that's the Philosopher's Stone. That's what would render all of this, it would neutralize the waste and we would be out of the danger.
And people would be out of fear. Radiation is a huge fear monger, and nuclear power plants have kept us in fear. We need to stop them. But that is, those are two very interesting things that I found, and Dennis Nestor is available on Facebook and on Skype, and you can find him there.
Well, you will send me the link, and I will post it on Nuclear Hot Seat, both the website and our Facebook pages, and get that information up. Just quickly, Elisa, you also are very involved with nutrition and what foods people need to be eating now to strengthen themselves against radiation, and also, I would assume, the foods to avoid. Can you give us a quick rundown on the yays and the nays in this?
Most of the information on foods to eat goes all the way back to Nagasaki Hospital. They had people eating very strict diets of brown rice.
Miso, it was the macrobiotic diet was what they were following.
Yes, and unfortunately, it's going to be very difficult to find sea vegetables that aren't from the Pacific Ocean. If people have seaweeds that they bought, for instance, in late spring, midsummer, those should still be clean. I'm finding it difficult to find seaweeds that are grown elsewhere. The Pacific Ocean is not safe. It's really not safe to eat fish from the Pacific Ocean or sea vegetables. And it's hard for me to say that because I have friends who have businesses collecting sea vegetables and selling them, and I'm not going to be buying them anymore.
I got my supply, I think, in the first 2 months after Fukushima happened. I just went to some local groceries and stocked up with enormous quantities of them because I could see that coming.
Miso also, people. The shelves were clear. It's the first time in my life I've ever seen shelves cleared in the grocery stores. All the miso was gone.
If people would like to be in contact with you for more information or have access to what it is that you know about bioremediation, phytoremediation, and mycoremediation, how might they get in contact with you?
I just made a new Hotmail for myself so that people can contact me, and the address is nonukes108, the number 108, so nonukes108 at hotmail.com. And I am making up a list of foods that people can eat and supplements and websites that they can connect with to help their families be safe.
Elisa, I have to say I have so enjoyed getting to know you and our friendship, which has been completely blossoming over Facebook, and sharing the information with you and your concerns. And I look forward to getting further updates, especially about this fascinating area of not only how we can remediate, but how we can possibly neutralize radiation so that it isn't the threat that it currently is. I'll be fascinated to learn more about that from you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It was really fun being here with you.
Terrific. Well, moving on, I invite you to stick around for the rest of the podcast where we have a little bit to go. And the next piece should be right up your line because it's in continuation. I always do a piece on holistic healing or radiation protection. And this one is, as you mentioned very early in the interview, you mentioned farmers markets. And many of us go to farmers markets every week to buy fresh organic produce. But even organic produce is subject to contamination by radiation as fallout from Fukushima makes its way into the soil, gets taken up into plants, it has rainouts, it comes down on the land, and it becomes squarely enmeshed in the food chain. And the question then is, what can be done? Well, in speaking to my farmers market organic farmers, I learned that nothing can be added to their soil unless it is approved by whatever organization is sanctioning their status as organic. So I contacted one of these groups, the Organic Materials Review Institute, which is known as OMRI, O-M-R-I, and I got a great reply and a shout-out here to Program Director Lindsay Fernandez-Salvador. She reported that federal organic regulations stipulate what you can and cannot use on an organic farm and or processing facility. In general, most natural materials are allowed, and most synthetic materials are not, except for a very small list of exemptions. I had queried her about zeolite, bentonite, and boron, all of which have been used at various times in remediation against radiation. She wrote back that zeolite and bentonite are both naturally mined clay materials and, barring any chemical treatments, would be allowed for use as soil amendments in organic production. Only certain forms of boron are allowed, including sodium tetraborate. Others are allowed only with a documented soil deficiency in boron. OMRI evaluates brand name products, so any brand name zeolite or bentonite that came through their application process would be welcomed for review in organic production. Any farmer can request their certification agency review inputs as well for compliance. So for all of you out there, when you go to your local farmers market, talk with the organic farmers about zeolite, bentonite, sodium tetraborate, and now mushrooms, so you can continue to enjoy the cleanest, most radiation-free, fresh produce available. And that's the holistic healing tip for today. Now here's our activist opportunity. Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner Christine Svinicki is fighting to hold on to her position as a commissioner for another five-year term. She's up for renomination as of June. Now, she's trained as a nuclear engineer, has voted against safety issues more often than any other commissioner, and consistently protected the industry through her current term instead of, as the Nuclear Regulatory is supposed to do, protecting people and the environment. She has also been one of the hardest working critics aimed at subverting NRC Chairman Yasko's attempts to increase reactor safety in the wake of Fukushima. She cannot be allowed to re-up. This is akin to fighting, let's say, a racist Supreme Court justice trying to get a lifetime appointment. It's not lifetime, it's 5 years. But what's at stake is influence that will last for years. There's still time to make your thoughts known. There is a petition available on NIRS.org. That's NIRS.org. And I will post a link on the Nuclear Hot Seat webpage. I'll also post a link there to a video showing Commissioner Svinicki in a very flat affect manner expressing her sympathy to Fukushima victims, followed by a business-as-usual nuclear report. She didn't even flinch in making the transition. The time to make your voices heard is now. And here's one final thought. This is from Arne Gunderson, our friend at Fairwinds.com. He said at the end of the video, quote, "Our government tells us we can store nuclear waste for 250,000 years, but we can't do solar because we can't store energy overnight." Think about it. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 15, 2012. You can find us syndicated to airprogressive.org, streaming web radio. We are posted on nuclearhotseat.com/blog. We're on the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat page and the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat group page. And if you're tired of all of those, you can always subscribe on iTunes podcasts. If you go to the new Facebook site that we have, please click on like. It will help us show up in the Google algorithm. This is Libby Halevy of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep. Be safe, be well, and I'll speak with you again next week.